The Second World War is the largest event in human history.
A 20-part series with Tom Hanks.
No part of the globe was untouched. No life unchanged.
Experience the ultimate account of World War II.
Every single person had a story. These are the stories that make us who we are.
Listen to World War II with Tom Hanks on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I started modeling when I was 12 years old, and like so many young girls, I dreamed of traveling the world and building a successful career. And modeling gave me incredible opportunities, but it also exposed me to environments where young people weren't always protected. So Jeffrey Epstein understood those vulnerabilities, and he used promises, opportunity, influential connections, and access to gain trust to exploit children.
This is a true crime roundup from the On Deadline podcast. We explore crime stories reported on by Odyssey's radio newsrooms across the country. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. This week, we're focusing on crimes that target children, adolescents, and young adults. Crimes that are often overlooked. These aren't grisly murder cases. They're incidents that often happen in a pattern, seemingly right before our eyes. Young athletes pushed beyond their limits until they die. Curious teens extorted to the point where they take their own lives. Jeffrey Epstein's systemic abuse of girls. That voice you heard at the top of the show belongs to model Charlene Rochard. She's an Epstein survivor. We'll hear more from her, as well as from Kansas City journalist Sam Zeff, on a trend that's been claiming the lives of student athletes. And we'll also hear from crime and terrorism expert Brad Garrett on sextortion scams that have been leading to teen suicides. First, we have some quick true crime updates, including an update on the Charlie Kirk assassination case, an update on the Lynette Hooker disappearance, and a Michigan crime that's become the inspiration for a novel. We'll start with a case out of Odyssey Station WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities.
35-year-old Jasmine Laws is accused of holding her 15-year-old daughter underwater on the 4th of July on a lake in Otter Tail County. According to court documents, Laws claims she took her daughter's phone and threw it in the water, which started a physical fight. She claims she acted in self-defense and the teen's head was never submerged, but multiple witnesses disputed her account. Laws is scheduled to appear in court for her next hearing on August 26th. Mark Fry, News Talk 830 WCCO.
In the Philadelphia area, Odyssey Station KYW News Radio provided an update on a recent shooting death.
A 38-year-old Philadelphia man was arrested and charged in connection with a shooting in Pensauken last week. The Camden County Prosecutor's Office says Khalif Armstrong beat the victim with a bat before shooting him on Haddonfield Road last Thursday. The victim was listed in critical but stable condition. Armstrong is charged with first-degree attempted murder, aggravated assault, and related offenses.
Odyssey Station KCBS Radio in the Bay Area reported on an attempted murder case.
From Oakland, Damian Clay is facing a charge of attempted murder. Mike?
We'll see that hearing gets underway in just about 25 minutes here at Alameda Superior Court. Now, the incident happened just after 1:30 in the morning, May 2nd on 18th Street, after the monthly First Friday gathering in Oakland. Damian Clay allegedly running on foot after hitting and injuring 8 people. He was only just arrested last week. Alameda County District Attorney Ursula Jones Dixon calls the incident a, quote, intentional act of extreme violence. Legal analyst Stephen Clark.
I think a big factor will be reverse engineering what led up to this incident to determine whether this was reckless driving or an intent to kill.
Now, Oakland has stepped up security at First Fridays, and Oakland Interim Police Chief James Beer says most issues don't happen within the scope of the event itself.
In fact, it occurs after the event's completely done.
An attempted murder conviction could carry up to a lifetime sentence. Reporting live in Oakland, Mike DeWald.
Odyssey Station WWJ News Radio in Detroit reported on multiple developing crime stories this week. including an incident that broke out at a gas station.
Taylor police attempted to pull over a stolen U-Haul on Monday morning around 11:30. The driver eventually pulled into the gas station where authorities say he allegedly pointed a gun at officers. The officers fired at him and he was taken to a local hospital for treatment. 38-year-old Sisquindry Smith was arraigned today on multiple charges, including fleeing and eluding, felon in possession of a firearm, and resisting and obstructing a police officer. His bond was set at $75,000. Smith's bond conditions include not leaving the state, surrendering his driver's license and passport, and wearing a GPS tether.
Then WWJ reported that
a Detroit man has been arraigned on first-degree murder and felony gun charges in connection to the fatal shooting of his girlfriend at their home. 49-year-old LaToya Reeves was shot in the chest and in the hand. She was taken to a local hospital where she later died from her injuries. During 69-year-old Keith Custer's arraignment earlier today, the correction staff said they were told that he had dementia. He didn't answer any questions throughout his appearance. Defense attorney Christina Harris says the initial meeting between her office and Custer ended without him responding to any of their questions.
I don't know for sure that this is indeed Keith Custer. He has not identified himself. The Detroit Detention Center states that they have identified him as such, and I object to his arraignment until we can properly interview him.
He was remanded until his probable cause hearing on July 20th.
A new novel from Pulitzer Prize winner Brian Grewal.
The Recap Show is an inside look into the world of global soccer and women's sports.
Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.
Grewal, a Metro Detroit native, just came out. This week, Grewal joined WWJ News Radio to discuss the new book and how it's inspired by a real Michigan crime story.
There is a new book out called River Deep. It is the second in a Bitterfrost series by author Brian Grewal, who hails from Detroit and actually at one time worked for the Detroit News and Bloomberg Businessweek, the Wall Street Journal, where you worked in the Washington Bureau and then the Chicago Bureau. And you were part of a team at the Journal that won a Pulitzer Prize for coverage of 9/11. But you've turned to being an author. And what is this new book all about?
River Deep, which is set in the fictional northern Michigan town of Bitterfrost, is in a sentence about a woman who is accused of drowning her twin infant boys in a river, driving them in, and they drown.
And so I guess it kind of follows the story of a lawyer who defends her?
Yes. Catriona Delaney is the woman who is accused. And her lawyer, who eventually winds up defending her, is Devin Payne, who was one of the key characters in the first Bitterfrost book. And the Payne family and the Delaney family don't really get along, so it makes for a rather fraught, but in my view, the author, interesting relationship going forward.
And then do you have other recurring characters in the second book?
Yes, there's a detective named Garth Klimek. He's in there. Jimmy Baker is a character who was really the focus of the first book. He's less important in this one, but he still plays a significant role. And then there's a couple of new characters, including Catriona, who is mentioned only briefly a couple of times in Bitterfrost, and now she is a major character and a point of view character. You're in her head once in a while.
And she's the person on trial, correct?
Yes, that's correct. And the story was inspired, if that's the word, Beth, by an actual case that occurred right down there in 1989. A guy named Larry Delisle drove his wife and his four young children into the Detroit River. The kids all died. And Delisle went through some hell. He's in prison, a life conviction, but he was interrogated for eight and a half hours and allegedly confessed. The alleged confession got leaked to the media, and it was a mess. He has appealed that conviction many times over, and that's kind of what got me interested, is his appeals, because it made me think, well, maybe he's not the only bad guy here.
Here's a WWJ report on Delisle from 2024.
The life sentence given to a Michigan man for murdering his four children more than 30 years ago. Lawrence Delisle drove his station wagon into the Detroit River in Wyandotte. He and his then wife escaped Delisle told the jury that his leg cramped and he couldn't get his foot off the accelerator. However, the jury didn't believe it and he was convicted. Delisle is asking the parole board to commute his sentence.
That year, Delisle's ex-wife blamed him for their children's deaths after years of supporting him. Prison records show that Delisle was still incarcerated in Michigan as of this year. 10 years ago this month, a 32-year-old black man named Philandro Castile was shot by police at a traffic stop. His killing led to protests, and the cop who shot him multiple times at close range was eventually acquitted, but let go by the police department. WCCO's Chad Hartman reflected on the case this week.
Officer Anima Yanez pulled him over. Taillight was out. And remember, they were looking for a suspect in a gas station robbery a few days earlier and stopped him because his wide-set nose. Oh, that seems fair. There doesn't seem anything troubling to that, does it, Dave? Every person who might have a wide-set nose, we should be pursuing with a robbery of a gas station, of course, but from a vehicle, we're going to see that someone's wide-set nose. That's just disgusting, right? So, Philando's pulled over. Officer told him his taillight was out. Asked for his license and registration. Philando says, "Sir, I have to tell you, I do have a firearm on me. Don't reach for it then. Don't pull it out. I'm not pulling out," Castile said. And seconds later, as we know, shot after shot after shot killed Philando Castile.
And all of it on a live stream.
That's right where I was going. It was live streamed on Facebook by his girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds. Think about what a big story that became in town.
Yeah.
Text me right now, 651-461-9226. When you think of this story, what comes to mind? It's just got to be the video, right? I mean,
of course. Yeah. It's the fact that there was video, that we had an incident of this magnitude live streamed on the internet, of course, not knowing what was going to happen.
Yep.
When the video began rolling. And then Diamond Reynolds' reaction.
Yes.
As
you killed him.
He's bleeding.
Yeah, and obviously very, very few saw it live. But went viral like this.
Mm-hmm.
And the endless debates. Okay. Did the right thing to say, I do have a firearm on me. But when he's reaching, is there confusion, the panic, the uncertainty, the panic from the officer, the panic afterwards, 7 shots, and then the decision by Ramsey County Attorney John Choi, because this wasn't a decision in front of a grand jury. This was him charging manslaughter. First time it had been charged, right? In our state. And he's found not guilty. Now, we would have it later with, what was her name? I have it here. Justine Ruschek? Was that the name in the alley?
Justine Ruschek Damon, I believe, was the full name.
Yeah, right. And obviously we'd have George Floyd, right? And obviously George Floyd became international. But the Philando story in our state, I mean, we weren't doing the show together. Where were you in 16? What station are you in?
I was at the 1500.
You're 1500, right? Yeah. I bet even as sports, as Dan wanted 1500 to be at that point, it was unavoidable for you guys at times.
Yeah, it was not something we talked about because it was sports focused, but you couldn't avoid the news.
You could not have.
Certainly not. I mean, you said it was big here, and it was obviously the biggest here, but the fact that it was available online and, as you said, viral like that, it was well beyond just the Twin Cities and Minnesota borders. I mean, this was, at the very least, nationwide.
Yeah.
It wasn't to the magnitude of George Floyd.
No.
For whatever reason, why that one garnered more attention and protests versus this. Maybe it's just because it was just adding one more to the fire, and finally George Floyd was the tipping point. I don't know, but.
Yeah. It was. Well, it was tragic, right?
Of course.
Here's a man. We would find out everything that he was doing at school, how popular he was. And in my opinion, the officer, without a doubt, made significant mistakes. It doesn't hurt him in any way comparable to Philando, because Philando was gone. But think about what it did for the officer's life. And then, like somebody says, police, racial profiling, what occurs to me? Sure as hell sounded like it to me, right, at the time. Nothing's changed my mind. Has it changed your mind?
No.
So we've had John Choi talking about this because there were changes in 2021 involving Ramsey County and John Choi. Movie violations increased to more than 90% of the traffic stops, and equipment violations to fall 10% or less in participating cities. St. Paul moving violations comprise about 74% of traffic stops in the 4 years before the shift. So think about that. The dramatic for these pretextual stops. Dramatic impact, John Choi said, around building community trust, getting to a better version of public safety, getting police really focused on the types of traffic enforcement that matter, speeding, careless driving, and impaired driving. You know, and there, I will admit at first I was torn on this too. Okay, because can you stop individuals who are potentially wanted by the law, involved in legal issues? But the data's held up on the pretextual stops and the amount of crime and who it's prevented. Sure, in an ideal world, Dave, where whites and blacks and men and women and everyone would be stopped and treated the same way, so those pretextual stops could continue. And this is not in any way, let me be crystal clear on this, in any way saying all officers, because it's not. It is absolutely not. But it's too many. The nose. You're stopping somebody because their nose looks like maybe something. And by the way, we would find out. No. Not close. So I think it's the right move. Don't you? Because the racial profiling in this town and across this country has been proven. For certain officers, it's nowhere near the majority, but it's too damn many. And the sooner those folks are removed from the department, the better. And to allow the folks who are good, very good, and great, and brilliant at their jobs to do their jobs where they don't look at it that way. But sadly, those numbers are still up.
Since this April, the mystery of what happened to Lynette Hooker, a woman who went missing on a boat ride in the Bahamas, has been stumping investigators. While her family has said they're suspicious of her husband, Brian, here's a new update on the case from Dana Wright and Sam Stevie III of the Dana and Parks Show out of Odyssey Station KMBZ in Kansas City.
All right, what's the update with Lynette Hooker?
So we have been keeping up with this story ever since it happened when she was reported missing on April 5th. Initially, her husband, Brian Hooker, claimed that they were on their dinghy headed back to their sailboat Soulmate from Elbow Cay in the Bahamas.
Yeah.
When Lynette just magically, mysteriously bounced off the dinghy with the keys in her hand.
Yep.
And was swept away by rough waters caused by the storm. He, despite having his cell phone on him, claimed he had no cell service, mm-hmm. claimed he tried for hours to find her in the dark, in the rapid water, made it all the way back to the sailboat. All these different details coming out, none of them making sense. The update today. Investigators with the Coast Guard are looking into the possibility that the Michigan woman who went missing in the Bahamas earlier this year may not have fallen overboard from a dinghy that her husband claimed, but instead
was thrown,
made it back to the couple's sailboat before she disappeared.
Oh, no way.
I told you, Brian Hooker previously told authorities that his wife had fallen overboard from the dinghy. They believe that there may have been a fight, a physical altercation aboard the sailboat. Of course, Brian Hooker has not been charged with the crime and denies any wrongdoing.
I've also, real quick, Sam, I've also read that according to GPS location data from either his Apple Watch or the boat or cell phones or whatever, that where he claimed they were when this happened does not align with the GPS data investigators have.
It would have also been very out of line from where he was heading to where he was going. The claim was they were returning from the Cay to the sailboat, and where he claimed she went missing was out in the middle of the bay. It doesn't make any sense. Investigators also found that he had technology on the boat, a very expensive infrared camera that looks for heat sequences out in the water for if you're out sailing
to find her.
And somebody falls, you can use that to see where they are in the water, even if it's dark, even if it's rainy. He did not use that. There was also a camera aboard the boat that, you know, just magically stopped working right before she went missing.
Yeah.
He also claimed that he was going to stay in the Bahamas until they found his wife. He then flew back to the United States within a day. And nobody knows where he is now. I hope authorities do, because I foresee charges coming down the pipeline.
Another high-profile case development this week happened in the Utah courtroom, where the preliminary hearing for Tyler Robinson, the alleged assassin of conservative activist Charlie Kirk, was held. Robinson allegedly gunned down the activist last September while he was on a college campus for a speaking tour. Tara Servatius of Odyssey Station 989 Word News Talk in South Carolina discussed the hearing with her co-host, Lee Rogers.
Lee, it's going to be interesting to see if they offer Tyler Robinson a plea deal. They've got great evidence in this case. We've seen more of it. In fact, there's a handwritten note in which he confesses to this. Made his mother gasp in the courtroom when she saw it. It wasn't supposed to actually get out. It wasn't supposed to be presented till the trial, but the video camera that was playing, they were showing another piece of evidence, accidentally, like, kind of swiped over it, and you can read it. So that would be the fourth time. That's a fourth confession. I mean, they got this guy coming and going.
Yeah.
So normally, if I'm a prosecutor, I'm not playing ball. I'm not offering you a plea.
Right. Why? Yeah.
We'll be keeping track of that case, so stay tuned for updates. Over the past 26 years, more than...
You've built a great podcast. The content's solid. The audience is growing. But the money, still not where it should be. That's where the Odyssey Creator Lab comes in. We host your podcast for free so you can keep doing your thing while our experienced sales team does their thing, finding advertisers and bringing in revenue. No fees, no stress, just real monetization. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.
20 Division I college football players have died from exertion-related illnesses suffered during a workout or practice. That's according to an analysis by the Howard Center for Investigative Journalism at the Shirley Povich Center for Sports Journalism at the University of Maryland. The Howard Center said that coaches rarely face repercussions for these deaths. But then, something happened this week. A former strength and conditioning coach at Bucknell University in Pennsylvania was charged Monday in the death of a freshman football player who collapsed during training. Sam Zeff of KCUR in Kansas City wrote about a similar death back in 2019. 19-year-old football player Braden Bradforth from New Jersey died from exertional heat stroke after just one practice in Kansas. Zeff joined Dana Wright and Sam Stevie III of the Dana and Parks show out of Odyssey Station KMBZ in Kansas City this week to discuss this disturbing pattern of student-athlete deaths. First, here's Dana and Sam's discussion of the Bucknell case.
It's important to me that we update this story because I believe this is the first time we are seeing criminal charges against a coach for the death, the preventable death of an athlete. Sent this to Sam last night. I said, here we go, from the Associated Press. A former strength and conditioning coach at Bucknell University has been charged in the death of a football player who collapsed during training and then died. Calvin C.J. Dickey Jr. was a freshman training in July of 2024 at the University in Pennsylvania when Mark Kolbus told him and other football players to do 100 up-downs. And I'm going to stop there because when we get to my interview with the journalist who's covered these deaths for us locally, some of these deaths involved something called up-downs. And all of the deaths have happened during the very first practices of the year when it's 110 degrees outside.
And up-downs are a very typical starting conditioning thing. I say starting not in the you're building up your conditioning, but when you first hit the football field for those early practices, they're just trying to see how hard you're willing to push. And they're incredibly difficult. Think like a burpee without the push-up.
Yep. He told C.J. Dickey and all of the other football players to do 100 up-downs along with full-body plank drills. Dickey also happened to have a sickle cell trait, a medical condition that we know increases the risk of serious injury or death following extreme exertion. Some of the local cases involved athletes who happened to have sickle cell. Some of them didn't. Some of our local cases involved athletes that had just gotten here from different elevations, different temperatures. Some of them didn't. Dickey was recruited to play lineman positions at the university. He started struggling and passed out, according to the Attorney General's office. Kolbus was the only coach present at the time. Dickey was taken to the hospital and died 2 days later. An autopsy found that his death was caused by the exercises along with that sickle cell trait, body weight, and something called exertional rhabdomyolysis, a rare but life-threatening condition in which your muscles literally start breaking down from overexertion. I also want to mention here that in so many of our local cases where we have lost young athletes, they are linemen. They are almost exclusively the big guys.
Yeah,
I mean, big guys in training who die.
It takes those individuals a longer time to acclimate to a new climate.
Kolbus had been told about Dickey's medical condition. He received training from the school on it. He is charged, and this is important, and I want you to talk to the coach in your life. This is the first time we've seen this, and once one domino falls, there's going to be a string of other dominoes that we're going to see fall here because these are wholly avoidable deaths. He is charged with felony aggravated hazing and misdemeanor counts of involuntary manslaughter, reckless endangerment, and hazing, according to the Attorney General's office. Bail is set at $10,000. The facts show, according to the prosecutor's office, this was an intentional, deliberate hazing perpetuated by a coach who knew CJ's health condition made him vulnerable to extreme workouts. The facts will show this defendant received information about CJ's health condition along with training about NCAA anti-hazing standards and disregarded the information. Now, Bucknell says active criminal matter. We can't talk about it, but we are cooperating with the Attorney General's office. So I did not know this. The NCAA now requires new athletes be tested for sickle cell trait. Its website states that the trait becomes a threat in rare situations where athletes push the limits of their physical conditioning. That is what happened at, this is a major college, you guys, at Bucknell. The trainer who was with these young men knew about the sickle cell and had these boys on day one of practice.
Yeah.
Overexerting themselves.
And I think that's probably what in large part led to the charges was the knowledge that was intentionally given to the trainer and to the coach about the condition of the player.
You have to ease them into the training regimen, is according to the NCAA. So KCUR Metro reporter Sam Zeff, my former boss, brilliant reporter, has extensively covered the deaths of several young football players here who all suffered fatal exertional heat strokes during preseason practice. Most of them, if memory serves, day one, the day they get here, they're outside. It's 110 degrees out.
They're wanting to impress the coaches.
They want to impress the coach.
For many of them, this is their only chance to get out of what situation they were in and, you know, start a new life in their college life.
This is part of our interview with Sam.
And just a couple of days ago, you know, when it was really muggy outside,
yeah.
And I start to think about, well, what football player somewhere in America
is packing his bags?
Right. And somewhere in America in August, some young football player at a junior high school, maybe a high school, is going to go to a sweltering practice, and that football player is going to be run to death. It happens every year. It happens multiple times a year. And I just sit back, especially now after 7 or 8 years of doing these stories. I'm kind of plugged into the exertional heat stroke community. It's pretty big. I mean, it takes in trainers, takes in parents, takes in coaches.
If the exertional heat stroke community is so vast, why do we keep having deaths here?
Well, because there are way more coaches than there are exertional heat stroke activists. And I think that there are places where it is not as regulated as much as Scott Anderson, a former head football trainer at the University of Oklahoma and a leading expert on this, says there still is in the football world a warrior culture.
Yeah, you're going to run them. You're not going to give them water, which right. I think is criminal. We'll get to that. These stories are so devastating, Sam, as a mother, as a father, you know this, because I've always had this vision in my mind that they are packing the high school buddy up. We've all had the senior boy in high school, and you're packing him up, and you are excited because they are going to play football. Their passion is football. They want to exert themselves because they want to impress the coach on the first day. And I always have this horrifying vision in my mind of the parents just bidding farewell to these kiddos, and then they get the call, and it's usually on the first day of practice or thereabouts. It's not 6 months in that this is happening.
No.
It is because of the lack of acclimation to the climate,
yep.
And in some cases, lack of water.
Water mostly doesn't play a role in this, but I'll tell you what it does. It is an indicator of the culture. If you're not going to let your football players drink water, you're going to do other dangerous things. And it is the warrior culture that we spoke about. I'll tell you something that when I did this very first story, and I'm doing research on this, and I know that the football players at Garden City had been denied water. And I'm doing some research, and I pull up a general order from the Marine Corps about physical activity, about physical training. And in the general order, it says recruits will be able to drink water any time they want.
That's the Marines.
That's the Marines. So if it's good enough for the United States Marine Corps, it certainly should be good for any junior college football player.
You know, one of the things, one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this is because every one of these deaths is just so disgustingly preventable. And you can't keep saying in athletics, well, we didn't know. We didn't know that the kid who just came to Garden City or from Minnesota, we didn't know that he was going to collapse and die on day one. I don't think after so many of these deaths, you can say that any longer. And I do think that this case might help talk some sense into some of the coaches who think this is never going to happen here.
Well, and he mentioned the Marine policy regarding new recruits and they can get water whenever they want. Now, I'm sure that there are people that could poke holes in that saying, well, yeah, they can get water, but what's that going to do for how tough they look or their recruitment ability? When I was doing research the weekend before, I don't remember, the first week it got really hot,
yeah.
And I was trying to put together a new story about how to acclimate to the heat. The U.S. Army guidelines say to not do heavy physical exertion in a new environment for the first 14 days.
Yeah.
It takes 14 days to acclimate. The first five, your body doesn't even know what it's supposed to be doing. It treats the heat as a literal existential threat. The next five, it starts to figure things out. And the following four, things kind of meet in the middle and you get to a point where you can actually go out and do some up downs on a football field.
I cannot imagine why they think
it's okay.
And I think what we need is education. We need training. We need everyone to understand that the ice bath is the only way to maybe help these young men in the moment that this happens on the field. It should never happen. The ice bath is the only way to save them in that moment. We had one of these idiots try to put a garden hose on the kid. My God.
And every college should have an ice bath on hand,
yeah,
ready to go if you're going to be doing this in the
absolutely
hot summer days.
Absolutely. We will follow that case. I will follow it with interest now that charges have been filed against that former coach.
As college athletes face the possibility of being worked to death, teens across the U.S. are suffering from a more private threat: online sextortion scams. According to an article published by USA Today last April, 30 cases of suicide in teen boys have been linked to these scams since 2021. This week, crime and terrorism expert Brad Garrett joined the program A New Morning out of Odyssey Station WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo to discuss the trend, as well as teen takeovers and how parents can protect their adolescents.
You're focusing in on crime targeting children throughout the country, and it might not be what we're picturing in our heads. Cyber criminals really exploiting young men in this country. What's going on here?
So it's typically a teenage, maybe young teenage boy who is on some social media site. Obviously, that's typically normal. Comes across an attractive female, also normal, starts interacting with her. One thing leads to another, and she, of course, it ends up not being her, of course, but she sends him pictures, explicit pictures of her, of a girl, encouraging him to do the same thing. If he does, then the cyber criminals have him. And at that point, he then realizes he's not dealing with her. He's dealing with bad guys, possibly in West Africa, maybe in Nigeria, who then state they're going to ruin his life. They're going to send the pictures to school. They're going to put the pictures online. And they demand money. And typically, you know, kids that age don't have a lot of money, but they start paying them. Some of them do. And it just never ends. I mean, they keep extorting them as long as they can get money out of them. Sadly, some of these kids take their own lives, just for the obvious reason, the sheer embarrassment, humiliation of those pictures being out there. The important part of the story, obviously that's important, but that how extensive this is worldwide. I mean, there's an Intel analyst, I believe his name was Paul Raphael, did a study and found that these type of extortions are occurring around the world, and that the extortion words that they're using are exactly the same in many cases. In other words, even the same misspelled words, clearly suggesting that the cyber bad guys are sharing how you do this with other cyber criminals. I think the numbers are really big. We don't know how much this occurs. I can only tell you that I think the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children would tell you they get in excess of 20,000 calls a year in reference to this subject. It's a really, really growing problem that's difficult to stop. And it really sort of boils down, in my view, your relationship with your own kids and whether they'll come to you if they come across something like this.
I mean, it's parents' worst nightmare. What advice do you have for them to help navigate and avoid something like this from happening?
Well, I mean, those of us who have teenage kids know you can only tell them or talk to them so much. And you can go through the scenario, a version of the scenario we're talking about. And that would they come to them if they come across something like this where a female sends them explicit photographs, whether they send something or not, if they tell you after the fact, you're going to have to deal with that. It's before the fact, you can clearly report them, get law enforcement involved, which you would need to do anyway, if in fact you have sent explicit pictures. But so it boils down, I guess, your relationship with your kid, the responsibility of being online, knowing that you never know who you're really talking to, and that when you put something out there, it's out there forever. That's sort of inadequate, as far as can you really put a stop to this? Because you really can't. The best you can do is protect your own kids and their environment.
On this idea of a teen takeover, I mentioned this at the start. Over the July 4th weekend here in Buffalo, we had 11 people hit by gunfire, 6 different shooting instances, and the blame is being put on one of these kind of teen takeover events. Somebody saying to everybody, hey, come on over to this location, just basically in the middle of a street in Buffalo. We're all going to hang out, and, well, violence erupts. We've seen this all over the country, Brad.
Yeah, that's correct. And as the three of us know, I mean, availability of firearms is pretty easy in this country, despite whatever age you might be. And so that makes it easy to have a gun. And in the wrong hands, with alcohol, drugs involved, egos involved, you end up in these kind of shootings. I mean, the number of shootings we have every day in some form, either some version of what you just described or just people angry, walking into a crowd, walking into a bar, going back to a party, and shooting a bunch of people, is sadly an everyday story now.
Police were overwhelmed in this case, as the commissioner said afterward. What is the strategy for police departments to handle these things?
Well, a lot of it is driven by intelligence that you have, which then obviously boils down to your relationship in the community. Two things. Who do you have out there in certain communities that will come forward and tell you things that they hear, things that they see, things that they've been asked to participate in? That's one aspect of it. The other is, can you get people in the community, beyond maybe kids this age, folks that have dealt with violence in their own communities, to get the word out, to come forward? The police are sort of limited here to a certain extent. I mean, they can't do anything about the proliferation of firearms, other than maybe targeting people that they know are illegally carrying firearms. But it's another one of those. The short answer here is there's no perfect way. There's no way that you could actually completely stop this. You just sort of have to figure out ways, can you reduce it?
Exploitation of teens can manifest as sextortion, as A New Morning discussed. It has also manifested in an elaborate system of abuse perpetrated by wealthy and powerful people, as the Jeffrey Epstein case has demonstrated. Epstein, a former financier with connections to rich and famous people, including U.S. presidents and household name billionaires, was convicted for soliciting prostitution from a minor. His associate, British socialite Ghislaine Maxwell, was sentenced to 20 years in prison in 2022 for a scheme to sexually exploit and abuse multiple minor girls with Epstein. By that time, Epstein had already been dead for around 3 years. He died in prison in 2019. The recent release of U.S. government files related to the investigation of Epstein have revealed more about this pattern of exploitation and abuse. At least one of Epstein's victims, Virginia Guffrey, has died by suicide. She was just 41 years old. Charlene Rochard, one of Epstein's survivors, discussed her experience with Scoot from Odyssey Station WWL in New Orleans, where a billboard from the survivors is urging Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy to vote against Todd Blanche as Attorney General. Blanche, who is now serving as acting Attorney General following former AG Pam Bondi's removal, has faced scrutiny over the handling of the Epstein case.
Can you take us back to the very beginning and how you first got involved in this world?
Yeah, sure. I started modeling when I was 12 years old, and like so many young girls, I dreamed of traveling the world and building a successful career. And modeling gave me incredible opportunities, but it also exposed me to environments where young people weren't always protected. So Jeffrey Epstein understood those vulnerabilities, and he used promises, opportunity, influential connections, and access to gain trust to exploit children. So basically what began as a dream became years of abuse.
So at the time that you, what age were you when you first met Jeffrey Epstein and got involved?
Well, I was a young teenager and I had just started traveling the world.
Okay. So was this the first time that you were sexually active?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, this had to be just a shock. But what do you say to the people who say, "Well, Charlene, how did you not know this wasn't right?" What I think a better question, Charlene, might be, "What did they tell you that made you think this was okay?"
Well, Jeffrey used a lot of manipulation techniques such as coercive control and manipulation. Like I said, he promised opportunities that you wouldn't have normally had if you were just traveling the world as a young person on the regular route of modeling. So when you get put in the situation of an older man, and children tend to trust adults, we are taught as a younger child to trust adults, that they can help you. You just kind of trust what they're saying, and that's how you get caught in this system.
So at the time, Charlene, you were willing to give up certain thoughts that you might have had about right and wrong to do this as a way of getting an international modeling career?
Well, it's not that I wanted to do anything or was willing to give up things. I was manipulated to think that I was just going in for one thing and then other things were expected of me.
So it sounds like you were put in situations that you were not expecting the outcome, but then the man there pushed for the outcome?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. And you were manipulated in such a way that you felt like you had to go along with them, that you couldn't resist. Let's say after the first time, did you voice an opinion about this to anybody, to Ghislaine or to Jeffrey Epstein?
I have several friends that I confided in during those years, and so they also didn't recognize the signs of what was going on. At the time, it's very hard to distinguish when you're just a young girl traveling the world and this adult is telling you things and you really want to believe them. So even the people that I told that were older than me also believed that these people were helping me.
Where are your parents in your life at this time?
Right now, my father's passed away, and my mom is still alive.
But where were your parents when this? Where were your parents when this was starting with Jeffrey Epstein?
So my mom was living in Canada, and I was away from home traveling. I traveled the world. I went all across the United States, New York, Miami. And then, of course, Jeffrey's Island. But then I also was traveling to Paris and Germany and Spain and Italy. So as a model, as a young girl, you literally go where the jobs are. So that's what I was doing.
So it's got to be difficult to say goodbye to a 12-year-old girl. But your mom thought that this was a positive thing for you?
Yes. So I didn't start traveling until a little bit later in my teenage years. And it was a dream that I had. And it's an opportunity that honestly most people don't get. So even today, you know, my daughters, I have a 14 and a 16-year-old, and they look at the influencers online. Well, when I was growing up, I looked at the magazines and the catalogs, and I was like, I want to be that girl in the magazine. And I grew up as a girl that a lot of people in my small community didn't accept. So when somebody finally accepted me and told me that I was worthy of actually traveling the world, being a model, having these opportunities, being on billboards, being, you know, on TV and commercials or acting in movies, I just thought, wow, this is amazing. Somebody actually accepts me and this is what I can do.
It seems like, though, the part about the physical part about having sex with older men, you didn't feel like you were giving up a lot to get to your goal?
Well, the manipulation starts slowly, so you don't just start out being raped. There is a lot of signs, red flags that I didn't notice at the time. So basically, you know, you go in, you start building trust with this person over time, and then things start happening, and then maybe they want you to go see somebody else. Or it's very common in the sex trafficking world to trust your abuser. And that's kind of what my mindset was at the time. I trusted that this person had the best interest for me.
Did you get a sense that these were rich, influential men that you were with?
Yes, definitely. I knew that these people were from political sources or really famous in the acting world or just had a lot of money in general. It was really obvious, and Jeffrey made that obvious. And so, again, that's another thing that makes you feel really small, is you're around all of these powerful people. And I was just a young girl from a small town with a dream, hoping for the best. It wasn't like I was out there selling myself or anything like that. It was just simply I was manipulated, I was put under coercive control to believe that these things that were happening to me at the time, I was honestly scared to tell anybody, first of all. Mm-hmm. You start to blame yourself, and I've lived in shame for many, many years over this. Like, how did this happen? Why did this happen?
Charlene, was your background and the way you got into this, was it similar to other girls that were doing this at the time?
So my background was that my parents were divorced when I was 11. I was living with my mom. And when my parents were together, it was a very volatile relationship. And so I am an only child as well. So when I grew up, I just really wanted somebody to accept me because I felt like small in the world that I was living in. My mom said I just kind of tucked myself away in a room and would draw and paint and really get involved in art. And she would have to check on me to make sure I was still there. So I was always a quiet, shy child.
Were other girls who were involved in this, did you have any contact with other girls that were involved in this? Were there, you know, did you guys talk about, hey, what's going on? Or, you know, how do you feel about this? Or, you know, what did they do? Or what did he do? Did you have conversations with other girls who were part of this?
Not really. And that's the interesting part. Jeffrey, for the most part, kept us apart. When I was on the island, I did meet some other girls and I did talk to them. But the abuse wasn't talked about because I really do feel that we were all under this guise of this person has the best intentions for us. Although, you know, you quickly learn that maybe they don't when horrible things happen, and then you begin to question yourself and blame yourself. It's not a good situation to be in.
Did you recognize any of the men that you were with?
At the time, yes. Yeah.
And when I ask you if you recognized them, you knew who they were?
At the time, yeah.
And they were wealthy, famous, powerful people?
Yes. And another thing to remember, too, is because I was a model, I was actually always around wealthy, famous people. So not only just with Jeffrey, but when I went to model parties in different places, they were all kinds of people. There were other models and actors, and I remember even Evander Holyfield. Like, there were people from sports everywhere, and it's just kind of was a lifestyle for me to be around these kinds of people. So it wasn't too far of a reach for me.
So, can you name the people that you recognize?
I would prefer not to name my abusers, but
Curious why. Why would you not want to name? I'm not pressuring you to name them, but why would you be reluctant to name the men that you recognize that were with you?
Well, if we go ahead and say things that are personal or could be in litigation right now, these people can turn around and just sue us for multiple reasons. So we don't usually name names just to keep our safety. And in fact, I've spoken out publicly, but you know what? The names are in the files.
Yeah.
So anybody can read them, and they're right there.
Would America be surprised at some of these men in this situation?
No, because these men, again, are in the files.
But the names, the speculative names that we've been hearing, you know, it's people we all know. So would most of America that's not exposed to the files, would they be surprised at some of the names that that are in there? And let me ask you this. Are the names that are in the files, without naming anybody specifically, are those names accurate?
I would say that the girls that have submitted 302s and already given FBI statements and those files that came out, that is their truth. And so they are going to stand by those names that are there.
When you were modeling at 12 years old, and you talk about the billboards and all the products, what were you modeling for? I mean, if I see an ad and this girl looks young, could she be 12 years old? What products were you advertising as a model at 12 years old?
Well, so when I was 12, I wasn't traveling yet, but I was modeling in my small town, actually doctor's uniforms and things like that.
All right. What about when you got a little bigger and you were still well under 18, what were you modeling for?
I modeled for all kinds of international campaigns. I did Levi's, Parasuco, LaVie and Rose, all those shoe companies, Kohl's, JCPenney. I was in a lot of ads, just honestly too many to...
You were underage at the time?
Yeah. It's very normal for girls. So I'm 5'9", and so because I was 5'9", I fit the clothes, and I was thin. So back in the day, you were either a size basically 0, 2, or 4, and they want the clothes to look like a hanger on you. And so I fit the clothes and I was tall enough. And so I was able to work.
Were you taken advantage of in those modeling situations with men around you?
There were some situations that I was not happy with, but it was nothing like being in a sex trafficking ring. I mean, there's always, you know, a creepy photographer or, you know, somebody that asks too many questions, a makeup artist or whatever. And it's just learning to navigate those questions and navigate the situations you're in. So, yeah, I was definitely put in other precarious situations as a model. And that's one of the reasons why I do speak out, is because I just don't want anything that happened to me to happen to anybody else.
Charlene, as part of Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking network, were you paid any money?
Well, when you went to go see Jeffrey, yes, most of the girls either got $200 or $300 when you went to go give him a massage.
And so is that the way it was basically set up, that you're going to give this person a massage, but it's going to go beyond the massage?
Pretty much, yeah.
So these guys are paying to be with underage girls, and the scenario is that they're going to get a massage, but then it develops from there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Do you talk to other girls who were part of that network now?
Yeah, I do. The survivors that are public, I basically talk to them every day. We have a really good survivor-sister relationship.
So what do you think is going to happen? Do you think we're going to ultimately see the full files released?
Well, I do know that Katie Fang just, you know, her deadline for getting the files fully released, the DOJ sent something out saying that they weren't releasing them. So a lot of documents were destroyed. I do know that Jeffrey destroyed a lot of his hard drives in Florida, and I heard that they were destroyed also on the island and probably New York. So no, I don't think we will ever really see the full picture. However, there are still 3 million files that we know of that the FBI has, and we are hoping that they will release them, but however, protect survivor identity. So that's the reason why we have put this billboard campaign out right now.
Is there going to be a time when you and the other girls can just openly talk about the men that we all know that were with you and the girls?
I think that it's a personal issue. And honestly, when I talk about it, it really brings up bad memories. So I would just rather not have those kinds of conversations. The conversations that the girls and I have are about, right now we're talking about a memorial and what that memorial's going to look like in New Mexico. And we talk about like ways to move forward. We don't really go back in our past too much.
Charlene, looking back, what were the red flags that you missed that if you saw them today, you'd go, I'm not going any further? What were the red flags you missed?
Oh, wow. There is a ton of red flags, but basically adults offering opportunities that seem too good to be true is one. Being told you're more mature than other girls your age, being given gifts, money, or expensive items without clear expectations, adults wanting to spend time with you alone, being encouraged to keep secrets, feeling like I couldn't say no to an adult like that had power or influence, and then the adults created a sense that my future depended on them. People gradually crossing personal boundaries so it doesn't feel obvious and you just don't notice. Mm-hmm. Another red flag is being isolated from family and friends. Adults who seem to know where you were and what you were doing, feeling basically in debt because someone was paying for travel or housing or opportunities. So you kind of make you feel like you owe them. Adults introducing you to wealthier, influential people, basically as it was normal, feeling uncomfortable, but convincing yourself that it's just the industry. I try to talk about the red flags a lot, actually, and so that people recognize all these signs. Believing inappropriate behavior was the price of success. That's another fallback. Having no trusted adult independently look out for your interests is another one. Adults making you feel special, chosen, or indispensable. Feeling responsible for making an adult happy. And basically, just trust your instincts. If your instincts tell you something wasn't right, but you believed you had no choice. So, like, I didn't feel like I had the ability to say no. I believed my career, travel, and my future depending on basically what I was told. You know, grooming doesn't usually begin with violence. It begins with trust, attention, opportunity, and the gradual erosion of boundaries. So that's why education is so important. And the sooner we recognize the warning signs, the sooner we can protect the children.
So much of what I hear from you sounds like the same thing that people say when they get caught up in some kind of religious cult.
Maybe, yeah.
You know, that there's it's this all indoctrination, the trust. Again, much of what you say is what people say when they look back and they realize they got caught up in some kind of religious cult.
Yeah, looking back, I realized I was being groomed. It wasn't one event. It was a gradual process of gaining trust, making me feel special, creating dependence, isolating me from people who might question what was happening, and making me feel like I just couldn't say no. And I just didn't see the red flags, because red flags don't look like danger. They look like opportunity, mentorship, travel, success. And now I can see how my choices were gradually replaced by someone else's control.
I have to ask this question, and I'm going to be very sensitive how I ask it, but I know people are curious. You had to be tense and not relaxed when you were in these situations.
Yeah.
But this was not good for you.
No, it wasn't. No.
Yeah. Charlene, I appreciate you taking time to talk to us, and I think it takes a lot of courage to talk about what you have talked about. I'd love to hear the names, but I respect your reason for not wanting to say the names, but I am confident one day we will know more than we know today. And I just, you know, I have talked about this on my talk show long before Jeffrey Epstein. I've talked about how there are rich, powerful men who support sex trafficking. Yes, there's a whole lower level of sex trafficking, but there are rich, powerful men who are known to this country and known to the world who support and create a market for sex trafficking, and these men should not be able to get away with it. They should be exposed. And there are a lot of men who have this appetite for underage girls that, to me, as a man, is deplorable.
Yeah, thank you for recognizing that.
Well, Charlene Rochard, thanks for being with us, and perhaps we'll talk again. And good luck with your journey. Good luck with all of the legal wrangling that's going on. And I hope things work out in your favor. I hope that all you've been through yields something really positive for you and all of the girls.
Oh, thank you so much. You have our billboard up. That's right.
Yes. Yes. The billboard is up. It's near the Caesars Superdome here in New Orleans. Very well-traveled area. So the billboard is up, and that's how we got your name.
That's amazing. Yeah, we just want people to trust in our justice system, and we just want you to know that what happened to us wasn't political. It was literally a crime against me as a child, and when asking senators to consider whether the next attorney general restores survivors' trust in the Department of Justice, and that's why we put that there, because survivors deserve leadership that protects victims and values transparency and restores confidence in our justice system. So we're really hoping that by that billboard that people will consider either signing our petition or calling their their senator and really thinking about who we want the next attorney general to be.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to WCCO News and Talk in the Twin Cities, KYW News Radio in Philadelphia, KCBS Radio in the Bay Area, WWJ News Radio in Detroit, The Tara Show out of 989 Word in South Carolina, The Dana and Parks Show out of KMBZ in Kansas City, A New Morning out of WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo, and The Scoot Show out of WWL in New Orleans. You can find these programs on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find these True Crime Roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
Hey, what's up, flies? This is David Spade.
Dana Carvey.
Look, I know we never actually left, but I'll just say it. We are back with another season of Fly on the Wall.
Every episode, including ones with guests, will now be on video. Every Thursday, you'll hear us and see us chatting with big-name celebrities.
And every Monday, you're stuck with just me and Dana. We react to news, what's trending, viral clips.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.